Welcome to the Global Research News Hour in the summer. My name is Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour airs on radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, on occupied Anishinaabe territory and on the homeland of the Métis Nation. It also airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. It airs on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm and is podcast at the website globalresearch.ca. The world seems to be sliding ever closer to a major powers showdown between Cold War rivals Russia and the United States. The NATO alliance has been encroaching on Russia's western frontier ever since the fall of the Berlin Wall. The enmity was knocked up several octane levels after America's attempt at regime change in Syria in the summer of 2013 was deftly thwarted by Russia. In the months that followed, a political crisis in Ukraine was orchestrated. The Maidan movement, sponsored and fostered by Washington-funded NGOs in the country, successfully forced the removal of Ukrainian President Yanukovych and the installation of a US-NATO proxy. The civil war in the south and east of the country is being blamed on quote-unquote Russian-backed rebels, and Crimea's democratic decision to withdraw from Ukraine and return to the Russian Federation framed as a seizure by the forces of President Putin. In recent weeks, increasing NATO troop deployments to Russia's western frontier have provoked threats of nuclear retaliation from at least one Kremlin official. All the while, Western media portray the situation as NATO defending Europe from an imperialist Russia. It is rare, even in left circles, for Western commentators to challenge these assertions. One notable exception is Roger Annis. Roger Annis is a socialist and retired aerospace worker and a longtime champion for peace and social justice causes. He is a founder and contributing editor of the website newcoldwar.org, and his articles have appeared at rabble.ca, counterpunch.org, globalresearch.ca, and his own website, rogerannis.com. Annis has been to Crimea since the February 2014 coup in Ukraine and presents a different picture of the Ukraine situation. The speech we are about to hear was presented at the inaugural Geopolitical Economy Research Group conference held at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg in September of 2015. In it, he provides factual information and a political analysis of the political conflict in Ukraine and its rapidly widening consequences internationally.
So this is a very destructive policy by the Canadian government of isolation and confrontation with Russia, using the pretext of the war situation in Ukraine. And this policy needs to end. And this election campaign should be a moment for this policy at least to be debated seriously among the political parties in Ottawa. At least have a debate. But there is none. There's unanimity. And it's shameful. And it should end. And that's part of what I'm doing presently, is working with people in the Russian community, and I should say also in some people in the Ukrainian community who would simply like to have some serious public discussion on this issue, which we have not had in Canada to date. And so I feel that my two trips now to the region helped me a great deal in that regard. This is our delegation meeting with one of the person at the center of the photo here is Boris Lifanov, who is, he's the director of the budget committee of the People's Republic of Donetsk. That was one of many, many informative visits we had during our 4 days in Donetsk. And the most important thing that we did is we went to the regions of Donetsk City, this is, we're in Donetsk City here, that are most affected by the war. That is, they're on the front line of the demarcation line, close to the airport in Donetsk. And these are people whose houses are being regularly, have been until the September 1st ceasefire, regularly shelled and bombed by the Ukrainian armed forces and by the right-wing militias with which the Ukrainian armed forces are allied. Now, I want to start today by saying, you know, I'm quite happy with things as they stand presently in eastern Ukraine. We've had a ceasefire in effect since September 1st, and this is really just, it's a renewal, or we could say an application of the ceasefire that was agreed to on February 12th of this year by the Ukrainian government with the rebel forces in eastern Ukraine, and this is being mediated by the governments of Germany, of France and Russia. But Ukraine has not respected that ceasefire. And the most important condition of all of the ceasefire is that the Ukrainian government talk with the rebel forces of eastern Ukraine and reach a political agreement that both sides can live with to put an end to the war and try to come to some agreement on the political and economic issues that are at dispute. And the Ukrainian government has not made a step in that direction. But it has been compelled by the events of the past few months to accept a ceasefire, which it was supposed to do back in February 12th, didn't do, and this is what we saw when we were in Donetsk in April, but I'm very happy to say that today, as of September 1st, the ceasefire now is holding, and that's very encouraging, so now we can begin to build on that. Now, I'm not going to have time to give you a broad overview of the origin of the war in Ukraine as I see it, and I think actually my colleague Anna is going to do quite a bit more on that than I'll do in this shorter presentation. But if you'd like to view the longer presentation that I gave following our return to from Donetsk this year, then you can go to our website and look in the video section of the website and find my presentation there, because I do go into quite a bit of detail there of the history of the conflict, the situation in Crimea, which I won't have any time to deal with today, and lots of other issues of language, culture, national rights in Ukraine, and so forth. I'm really, I guess today you could say, giving you a bit of a shorter version of what I presented a few months ago, but of course updated by, you know, very important developments, most notably the ceasefire of September 1st, but others as well. Now, my view of the Euromaidan movement, as it's called, is that this is a very complex phenomenon. As we know, what came into power in February of 2014 in Ukraine was a right-wing neoconservative government. That's what I call it. Others have different descriptions of it. But of course, which was also allied closely in politics with extreme right forces, including neo-Nazi forces. This is what came into power in February of 2014. In Ukraine. But of course, that doesn't mean that everyone that was out on Maidan Square was supporting this kind of government. What happened was a very aggressive intervention by neoconservative and right-wing, extreme right-wing forces to turn this Maidan movement towards the type of pro-European Union and pro-austerity policies that it represents, because the two go hand in hand now. If you support the European Union as it exists today, that means you're supporting harsh austerity policies as well. But that doesn't mean that everyone in Maidan Square had this in mind. The interests that were present on Maidan Square were complex. They were sometimes conflicting as well. But what came out of that, the end result of that, is a right-wing government in power in Ukraine. But it's very important for us to understand this right-wing government does not have the universal support of the Ukrainian people. Ukraine is deeply divided precisely over the course of this government, and significant numbers of Ukrainian people, not just in the east of the country, but elsewhere as well, oppose austerity, oppose the hostile attitude to Russia that this new government has. They certainly oppose the war, the civil war in the east of the country that this new government has been perpetrating, and so on. So we're dealing with a very complex phenomenon at all levels here. And it's very important to keep in mind what is really driving the war situation in Ukraine is not just internal to Ukraine. The member governments of the NATO military alliance have been aggressively pursuing a course of confrontation and pressuring and cajoling and even threatening the Ukrainian government to sustain and deepen this course of confrontation with Russia. So it's very important to keep in mind the aggressive foreign interests that are at play in Ukraine. And this is one map that says it all. This is the expansion of NATO after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989, which the member countries of the NATO alliance said they would never do. They said, don't worry, the new Russia, don't worry, we're not going to take advantage of your chaos and the collapse of the existing political order to advance our own interests. And they lied from the get-go. They never intended to build a new and peaceful Europe. They intended to take advantage of Russia's moment of weakness and disarray, and that's precisely what they've done, and Ukraine is just the latest step in this step-by-step. You see by the colorations here, the different dates of advance of NATO towards the east. So Ukraine is just it's the new color here. They haven't quite added you'll see Ukraine is still in color white here on the map, but you could put a new color there for NATO's ultimate intentions. Now, whether they'll get to a situation where they will have this country of Ukraine as a NATO member, we'll see. That's far from certain or far from determined in advance. But this is the reality underlying the conflict in Ukraine more than anything else. Or let's put that differently. This is one of the two realities underlining the conflict in Ukraine. The other part of the reality is the aggressive policy and intentions of the Ukrainian government itself. And there's a commonality of interest going on here. Although in the course of this confrontation, this independent country of Ukraine is becoming more and more subordinated to the imperialist powers, to its west, represented above all by the NATO military alliance. And that's an important part of this story. Now, what we know less of in the events over the last 18 months is the protest movement, which is called Anti-Maidan, or it's called the Russian Spring, but the protest movement that sprung up across Ukraine, and not just in the east, not just in Donetsk and Lugansk, but also in Odessa. Everywhere you see in this map, basically this is the coloration of the very significant protest movement that rose up and said, whoa, wait a sec, we don't agree with this course of orientation towards austerity Europe. We don't want a hostile policy towards our neighbor country, Russia. We don't want to see this militarization of Ukrainian society, this ambition of even of joining NATO. And so what was the attitude of this new Ukrainian government to that? Did they say, oh, well, half of our citizenry doesn't agree with our course. We have to talk about this. We have problems here that we should try and resolve. No, no. The attitude of this new Ukrainian government was put up and shut up. This is where we're going. We're going to become an anti-Russia, pro-EU, and pro-NATO country. And if you don't like it, it doesn't matter. You don't have a voice anymore. And furthermore, if you protest in the streets, we're going to send violent people to suppress this. And that's precisely what was done in Ukraine in the weeks and months following the overthrow of the government in February of 2014, including this was intended in Crimea. And the reason why Crimea was able to step aside and avoid the course of civil war was because it was the only part of Ukraine that had its own autonomous political authority. It had an autonomous government in Ukraine, in Crimea. And this elected government, part of the Ukrainian constitutional setup, organized a referendum in March of 2014 and said, we're not going to be part of this future Ukraine. In fact, we have a lot of historical grievances that we've not been able to resolve because Ukraine has not been in democratic space to do it, and we're going to resolve it now. So, you know, in a nutshell, that's what happened in Crimea. Now, there's a certain tragedy to the Russian Spring, which is that in all these areas here that are colored, where the opposition to the Ukrainian government was strongest, there's only one part of, or two parts, shall we say, Donetsk and Lugansk, where the people became well enough organized to actually resist this right-wing government, resist its militarization, and resist its violent attacks on them. They were not so lucky in places like Odessa and Kharkiv. The level of political organization of the masses was not sufficient. It was in Donetsk and Lugansk. That's partly due to the proximity to the Russian border, for sure. It's also due to the geographic distance from Kiev. It took longer for Kiev's paramilitary battalions to arrive in this part of the country and suppress the people who were saying we want dialogue, not confrontation. That's why you had the rebellion successful in the most eastern parts. And of course, there's historical reasons too. This part of Ukraine is much, there's a deeper, you could say, I think, a historical and political consciousness there. But all of these regions that you see colored had significant opposition to this change of course by the new Ukrainian government, but they were not able to organize quickly enough and effectively enough to resist the violent assault by the new right-wing government. And so this is the tragedy of the Russian Spring, is that they are now captive. Outside of Donetsk and Lugansk, the people of Ukraine are captive to this right-wing government, and it's very difficult to protest today. It's not impossible, but it's very difficult to protest. And so this issue will be resolved in the months and several years ahead, because these people will be heard. They will not be excluded from whatever Ukraine becomes. So the anti-Maidan rebellion, it's a very complex thing, and this is something that analysts in the Western imperialist countries really need to sit down and spend some time understanding, because it's not simple and it has its own unique characteristics. These are the four essential characteristics that I see in my understanding of the rebellion that's taken place across southern and eastern Ukraine. These could also be used to describe parts of Crimea as well. There's a lot of important distinctions about Crimea that make it unique, including how it succeeded in avoiding civil war, but I don't have time to go into those. But you know, these are four really important characteristics for understanding what's fundamental about the rebellion. Now, this doesn't describe it overall. The rebellion overall, you know, there's no one term that describes it. And within, you know, this generally positive picture that I present here, there's lots of complications. And there's political forces involved in the rebellion that I wouldn't necessarily even share, but I think the overall trend is we're looking at a positive popular reaction to a violent right-wing reactionary conservative regime in Kiev. And this movement of opposition deserves support across the board because of what it is fundamentally. And these key demands of the Russian Spring Movement, now this is at the origin of the Russian Spring Movement. Things have changed because the civil war changes things. And so the issue now of having real political, certainly autonomy, if not independence, is very much on the minds now of people in Donetsk and Lugansk and in these other regions where they have not been so successful in resisting Kiev. So none of this is frozen in time. But when you look at the key demands of the Russian Spring at the outset, you see something roughly not dissimilar to the constitutional setup of Canada, where we have provincial governments that have substantial, not just economic powers that they exercise, including the taxation even, but they exercise significant cultural and language policies. Province of Quebec being the best example, but this province here of Manitoba being another one. That's roughly what the people in eastern Ukraine wanted. Not very radical on the world scale of things, but way too radical for the Kiev government and way too radical for the NATO countries, including Canada, that's not prepared to have Ukraine with a constitutional setup similar to Canada's own constitution. They want a Ukraine that's subordinate and really a neo-colony of the West. Now, I want to just say a few words about what I think Ukraine is, because this is a subject that requires a lot more attention by scholars, but also by political activists. Ukraine is a country, and that may not sound too controversial to you, but among some people in the world, that's controversial, because there's a view that Ukraine is really not a country. It's this strange construct that emerged out of the Soviet Union and, you know, was not really independent anymore, maybe it never was, and so on and so forth. So, you know, this, which I won't go through point by point, but affirms that this is a, you know, this is a profoundly important country with a deep and profound history, cultural, linguistic, and otherwise. And I think that this needs to be recognized as we take account of going forward in Ukraine. And this is just one little map to show you the complexity of the country that we're talking about. This is nothing similar to Canada, for example. We have a significant French language minority here, but you know the role of the French language in Canada pales in comparison to the role of the Russian language in Ukraine. And that's not a problem. It's a great thing to have a country like Ukraine with many languages and many cultures and even you know varying histories depending on the region of the country. Nothing wrong with that at all. This is something we can build on. On the contrary, this is good, but it's complicated and it requires complicated political resolution. And here's another map that gives you an idea of the complexity of the country that we're talking about. Ukraine only came together 100 years ago from very sort of disparate backgrounds. And you know, we met people in Donetsk earlier this year who said, why the heck did we become part of Ukraine back in 1918? Because that was these borders were initially the consequence of the Russian Revolution of 1917. Very progressive borders in their time. But there's people in Donetsk today say we should have been part of Russia from the beginning and we never would have these problems today. So, you know, it just gives you a small illustration of the complications that we're talking about. So what is Russia? This is the most misunderstood question of all in the present conflict, by far. I mean, Ukraine's a complicated place and hard to understand, but the misunderstanding and the abuse of the presentation of Russia across the political spectrum, I'm sorry to say, including on the left, is just, you know, it's overwhelming. We're talking about one of the biggest countries in the world, well, geographically largest country in the world, a major military power, the largest combined oil and gas producer in the world, and obviously a major country in the politics of the world, but what is it? And you know the answer to that question that we get? Phrases. Russia's imperialist, Russia's aggressive, Russia's bad, Russia's good. Where's the analysis of what is this country? It's 25 years since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Is it a capitalist country? I think most people agree on that. Is it a progressive country? Wildly different views on that. But the biggest question of all, I think that those of us on the left have to answer is it an imperialist country or not? Because if, first of all, you have to know what you're talking about if you're going to make a serious analysis of a political conflict. But if, depending on what your analysis is, there are consequences. Countries act according to what the very nature of their economic and social condition is. And I make a forceful argument, and other colleagues with the New Cold War website make a forceful argument that no, Russia is not a capitalist country. Now, many people jump simplistically to the conclusion, oh my goodness, Roger Annis or the New Cold War website is that Russia is sort of a progressive country in the world playing a very progressive role. Well, why would you conclude that? Let's talk substantially of what Russia's role is. In the case of the conflict in eastern Ukraine, yes, Russia's playing a progressive role because it's refusing to obey NATO's orders and accept whatever NATO wants it to do. You know, don't support Crimea, turn your back on the rebellion in eastern Ukraine, don't support the rebels in eastern Ukraine, and so on and so forth. Well, Russia's not prepared to do that. Hallelujah. When have we seen governments in the world with the, you know, with the will to stand up to imperialist diktats? Why would we not welcome this? Now, does this mean that Russia is today's capitalist Russia, you know, is a model for social development, either for the Russian people or others in the world? I don't think so. I'm a socialist. I want to see a socialist Russia in which, you know, the wealth is truly shared among all the population. And of course, Russia already does this, but we want Russia to be more of solving the problems of underdevelopment in the world and also the ecological emergency that we're in the world. So I mean, that's what I think in Russia. But that doesn't mean I'm going to be just have some blind phrase to understand the country. And I'm certainly not going to misrepresent what Russia's role has been in Ukraine. Russia's role has been primarily reactive to an offensive by NATO and by this right-wing government. So I don't see the problem in saying that. The world's a complicated place and nothing is black and white. And I think when you get into the substance of the matter, which I can only do here in these point forms, you see that Russia is a very different place than the imperialist countries, the countries of North America, Europe, and Asia. And I have a convenient little map here. I mean, here's the imperialist division of the world. Dark red is a pretty good measure of the social reality of the countries in the world today. And those that are colored here in red are the ones that have very significant levels of wealth and development greater than all the other countries. And you can see that Russia, in terms of per capita wealth, which is a very important measure of a country, is not even in second tier in the world. But Russia is actually in the third tier. Its per capita wealth is comparable to, I mentioned in a note here, to South Korea and Brazil. It's far from anything in North America, Europe, and in Asia there. So this is what we have to understand, because if we understand what Russia is, then we have a lot easier time interpreting events in Ukraine. But if we come to this issue with phrases that Russia is imperialist, well, then it's pretty easy to make the leap and say, well, whatever they're doing in Ukraine must be bad because they're imperialist, right? And boom, end of discussion. You call it a serious discussion? You call that serious analysis? No. And this is part of what we need to turn around in the Western countries is let's have some serious discussion about what Russia is, and let's get rid of the phrasing that is used to simplify a complex problem. So what do I think are the prospects? Well, I wrote these notes roughly almost 3 months ago after returning from Donetsk, and I wouldn't change them that much. Even though it might be a desirable outcome to see Donbass stand as an independent republic, and certainly many people there would want to see that, I think that might win a majority of votes today, if there were a referendum in Donetsk and Lugansk. I think a majority would vote for some kind of independent republic, but only because Russia won't accept them as Russia did with Crimea. And that's for a host of different reasons. Well, you can imagine what would happen to Russia on the world stage if it were to accept Donetsk and Lugansk as it did in Crimea. Russia did the right thing in Crimea. It respected the will of the Crimean people. Unfortunately, it's in a much more difficult situation to do that today if there were a referendum and if a majority said we want to join the Russian Federation. So, you know, that's kind of off the table. So now we're talking about what's the best possible arrangement with this Ukraine that Donbass is part of. And I think the best arrangement is, you know, to come to some political agreement with Kyiv. Now, that's going to be very difficult to do because this, as I said, the government in Kyiv is still not talking to the rebels. So it's, you know, it's easy for us to theorize what an ideal settlement would be. This first one is probably the most realistic, but we cannot say with confidence that it would actually happen. You know, and then the other alternatives that I point to are there, but I think we're less likely to see in a short term, even if, you know, I could be convinced in theory that, you know, an independent Donbass or even this new entity called Novorossiya, after which people, you know, certainly a strong minority of people in the east and south of Ukraine would like to give serious consideration to that. But unfortunately, the world is not a very fair place today, and people don't get a free choice on what they want. They're usually stuck with, you know, something less than what they would like, and that's certainly the case for people in Ukraine today. So what should we do in the face of all this? Well, I think we have some pretty simple and straightforward tasks. We have to be active politically to oppose this intervention by the NATO powers in Ukraine and against Russia. And that means opposing the economic sanctions against Russia. It's a scandal, and I'll repeat it again, it's a scandal that the political left in most of the advanced capitalist countries of the world don't even talk about the sanctions regime against Russia. This regime should be opposed. There should be no sanctions against Russia. Sanctions are just a step towards war. That's always the role that they played in history, and we should stop that and cut it off. And of course, as I've already said, we should support real, genuine autonomy for the people of Ukraine. And we have a particular task in Canada, which a lot of people younger than me will seem coming out of the blue, Canada out of NATO. This was the policy of the New Democratic Party until only about 10 years ago it was changed. We need to put that back on the political agenda. Canada should be out of NATO. This is why we should be concerned about Ukraine. This is where this thing is going if we don't stop this NATO offensive. And you know what? The United States is renewing its storehouse of 20 nuclear weapons in Germany presently as we speak. They're putting in more modern nuclear. What on earth do they have in mind? Well, use your imagination. They've done it twice in history already, in the United States, that is. But the other very compelling reason why we have to be acting against the war in Ukraine is we have a much bigger problem in the world today. It's even bigger than militarism, large as that is. We have a climate emergency on our hands. And why are we wasting time with war and confrontation in Eastern Europe? And why are we destroying the countries of the Middle East with war? And why is there so much difficulty and misery in the world when we should be coming together rapidly to tackle the climate emergency, which is not in the future. It's happening now. The refugees in their millions, that's coming. And we'll have to get ready for that. The people living at sea level, we're going to have to move. The countries whose food production patterns are going to change vastly because of changing weather patterns, we've got to get ready for that. We've got to be talking about that right now. But what are we doing? These imperialist powers are wasting our time and our resources with military confrontation. So this is the course that we need. And I'm more confident than I was 18 months ago that we can see down the road a political resolution to the conflict in Ukraine, which would be great for the people of Ukraine. But this task of creating a world of justice and a world that begins to tackle the climate emergency, that's before all of us. And I think part of getting to that is opposing every one of these military adventures by the imperialist powers, so we could really be focusing our time and energies on what's important in the world. So thanks so much for your time and patience.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour in the summer, broadcast on radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. The show is podcast on the website globalresearch.ca and also airs on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. For the duration of the show, we will air an interview with Roger Annis, conducted by Chris Cook of CFUV in Victoria, for the radio program Guerrilla Radio. In this discussion, Annis focuses on a February 2016 article he had written about the Syrian ceasefire agreement and the increasing agitation for militarism expressed in Western capitals, including in Canada. This interview aired on March 2nd.
Now, Roger, now before we get to your Syria piece and what we can expect to come of the cessation agreement, we talked last in August about the situation surrounding the investigation of the shootdown of flight MH17 over Ukraine, the passenger liner from Malaysia. And now the propaganda Wurlitzer was warming up again last week, this time echoing a report attributed to the dodgy Bellingcat website in Britain and then amplified duly by The Guardian over there and The Washington Post on this side of the Atlantic. Now, the Dutch Safety Board is ostensibly in charge of this 18-month-long investigation so far, are due soon, they tell us, to conclude their investigations and release their full findings. Now, what's the latest you have on the Bellingcat revelations implicating Russia and, of course, Vladimir Putin in this shootdown, Roger?
Well, there's four paths of the investigation following the shootdown. And remember now, we're talking 18 months ago, so... you know, nothing definitive yet. The first was the report of the Dutch Safety Board issued on October 15th. This was a report purported to simply identify the cause of the crash, not to ascribe, criminal responsibility. So the Dutch Safety Board concluded that the plane came down due to a ground-to-air missile, and then Western media went crazy with the story. Ah, it must have been a Russian missile, and maybe if not fired by them, fired by people that they're supporting in eastern Ukraine. So that was the aftermath of the Safety Board report, which came out on October 15th. Now, there is the parallel criminal investigation, which is being conducted by five self-appointed countries, the five that suffered the most number of losses on board flight MH17. So the criminal investigation, which does have as a goal to find criminal responsibility, well, that's just, chugging along. The chairman of that, what's called the Joint Investigative Team, did send a letter to families of the victims from all the different countries that were on board the plane in mid-December, outlining where things stood as they saw it. And basically, we don't have, with the criminal investigation, a concurrence with the conclusion of the Dutch Safety Board. The criminal investigation is not saying that it has definitive evidence of a surface-to-air missile, and so on. And so there's many layers of complication to this. But that's where things stand. They say they have not come up yet with the conclusive evidence, including still to this day, the United States and Ukraine has not shared with the criminal investigation, at least in a way that can be made public, the satellite and radar data they have of what happened in the air that day, July 17, 2014. And so that's the criminal investigation. And by the way, I could add that the Australian police have also said that they indicated they disagree with the Dutch Safety Board conclusion. And the reason this came about is the third path that I'll mention, which is that there's been one coroner's investigation into the shootdown. That is one country coroner's investigation, and that was in Australia in December. So only one coroner's investigation so far, not in Holland, not in Malaysia, not in the other countries where victims of the crash were from, no, just Australia. And basically the Australian coroner said, well, we agree with the Dutch Safety Board, end of story. A very good article responding to the Australian coroner's investigation is on our website in that page that we have devoted to the Malaysian Airlines crash. One interesting thing that came out in the coroner's investigation is the Australian police indicated that they are not convinced by the Dutch Safety Board's conclusion. So, multiple layers of complication. Finally, the question of lawsuits. There's only been one formal lawsuit deposed, and it's by the daughter of one of the Dutch victims, and she's taken that to the European Court of Human Rights. The court is basically punting that whole issue around and indicating that it's probably not going to deal with it. But the specific point of that lawsuit is to hold the Ukrainian government accountable for allowing the plane to be over a war zone in Ukraine in the first place on July 17, 2014. So to make a very complicated story summarized, that's where things stand, and I would encourage readers that want to learn more to go to the page on our nucoldwar.org website devoted to this whole ongoing issue of the investigation.
Yeah, and we got to remind people that almost there was 298 people killed in this airliner shootdown. There was a lot of anomalies, and the fact that that airliner was where it was when it was, there's a whole story behind that too, enough to fuel a lot of conspiracy theories, or maybe not so theoretical after all. Now, this Bellingcat chap, what do you know about the Bellingcat website and Elliot Higgins, who is the mastermind behind it?
Yeah, well, this is it's a website run by a resident of Britain, and it's been on a crusade against the Russian government, both with respect to Syria and now with respect to the war in eastern Ukraine and the crash of Malaysian Airlines. Now, interestingly, one of the things that it did, and it's, you know, it's been trying to do a lot in the story, but it's basically had from the beginning said, well, we have photo and video evidence that a missile shot from territory controlled by the pro-autonomy forces in eastern Ukraine shot down Malaysian Airlines Flight 17. Well, the criminal investigation is saying that it has no video or photo evidence that it could rely on in any criminal prosecution of who it might be responsible. So that's one small part of the story. But you could go to, again, some of the investigative reporters that are pointed to on our website page, and who go into some detail to basically expose, fraudulent use of a photo and video material purporting to show a missile being shot from the ground on that day in July 17, 2014, against the airline. So it's sort of multiple layers of obfuscation and creation of evidence purporting to prove that the Russian government, if not directly involved, had a hand in the shooting down of the airplane. And, it's kind of wearing pretty thin these days, and the official investigations are not really paying serious attention to what Elliot Higgins and the Bellingcat, so-called Bellingcat website project are conducting.
Well, yeah, and he first came, Higgins first came to prominence, you mentioned Syria, during the Ghouta gas attacks, and they were parlayed by the Americans into some pretty bellicose language that could have led to a full-scale American invasion of Syria, and I think that was the intent of the people behind it. President Obama backed off at the last minute, and the whole case behind the so-called evidence fell to pieces, and Bellingcat, the Bellingcat site, not called that then, was in the middle of it. Elliot Higgins was, and he was totally, all of his evidence was excoriated by experts over at offguardian.com. They've looked at the Bellingcat site, and they've ripped him to pieces and say that basically he's now being used as a tool of intelligence to release information whenever it's convenient to his spook masters. Why do you think Bellingcat is now, just as the Dutch Safety Council, or Safety Board rather, are starting to release more information on MH17? I mean, is this the reason why we're all of a sudden seeing Bellingcat parroted in The Guardian and The Washington Post?
They're trying to keep the story hot and alive. And it's also in relation to what you said earlier about the gas attack and the movement towards war in Syria. Remember, the British Parliament took a look at this and said, no thanks, voted in the majority. It was a big slap in the face to Prime Minister David Cameron at the time. So, if we look at the whole situation in eastern Ukraine and now Syria, it doesn't matter what the news is. It doesn't matter kind of what facts on the ground tell us. There's an agenda to keep up the propaganda war against Russia, which could lead to who knows what eventually. And I think this is just part of that general pattern that we see across the board, whether it's the crash of the Malaysian Airlines flight, situation in Syria, situation in Crimea, situation in eastern Ukraine. There's a common thread to all of this, which is that goes back to the origin of all this stuff in the first place, which is NATO seizing upon the events in Kiev, Ukraine, in January, February of 2014, to launch a new Cold War against the Russian Federation.
Yeah, and sadly, and I mean, people that identify on the left politically, for whom the Guardian and the Washington Post are legendary. I mean, they may be most disappointed of all to see this neoliberal war mongering take place in the papers that they thought they could trust.
The Guardian is an example of a paper with a very kind of strong liberal image. But boy, I mean, we've been through the wars with them on the issue of Ukraine. This is, you mentioned the website Off Guardian. It was created by people in Britain who are just so fed up with how the Guardian was being used simply as a propaganda tool to promote a very dangerous military escalation in Ukraine and throughout Eastern Europe. So yeah, that's where we've been for 2 years, and doesn't matter what happens. The propaganda intent remains. They suffer setbacks in this, but the drive remains.
Well, and that's fine enough for the British and the American press. What about in Canada? How's Canada been treating this, or the Canadian press?
Well, I wrote a piece on this a month. I wrote a piece on this a month ago because, or a little less, yeah, about a month ago now it was, because the new Minister of Foreign Affairs, Stéphane Dion, made some public pronouncements saying that we have to begin to dialogue again with Russia. And he took some flack for that, including in the House of Commons, coming from the Conservative Party. In fact, I think even the NDP was criticizing him for this. So I looked at this, and there's not really much to be said here. There's been no change in Canadian government policy, but there are some substantive issues where they really have to be dealing with Russia. I mean, not least the situation in the Arctic. These are the two largest Arctic countries of the world, but also just this whole stonewalling that marked the Harper years, and which I should say, was a stonewalling entirely shared by the opposition parties, both the Liberal Party and the New Democratic Party. They want to do some public, you could say, public relations image shifting on that. But I don't think there's really any substance there. There's no change in, for example, the economic embargo against Russia. There's no change in the propaganda war blaming Russia for events in Ukraine and Crimea and trying to blame Russia for Syria. So, new government, somewhat new language, but same old policy.
Well, in another area where there's non-partisanship in the Canadian House on Ukraine is the fact that there's Canadian soldiers training these actors from the coup government in Ukraine in the western regions of the country, military trainers providing the know-how to what have been described by you as fascists and thugs.
That's right, and this is a very important point. Canada's military training in Ukraine, which I will call military intervention, because this is so-called training intended to put the Ukrainian army in shape for who knows what. This military intervention continues, no change whatsoever in that. And really, there's been a couple of other very disturbing developments on the Ukraine file. And the worst was the visit to Canada of a man who's the deputy speaker of the Ukrainian parliament, Andriy Perebyi. He was in Toronto on February 22nd, speaking at the very prestigious Monk School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto. And then the next day he was welcomed to Ottawa to the office of the Prime Minister of Canada. Who is Andriy Perebyi? He's the founder of the modern extreme right, call it fascist movement in Ukraine, going back to the early 1990s, and was the leader of the paramilitary battalions that spearheaded the overthrow of Ukraine's elected president in February 2014. And then he went on to, he was kind of one of the masterminds of the launching of the civil war in eastern Ukraine. He was welcomed to the office of the Prime Minister of Canada on February 23rd with, photos in the right-wing Ukrainian press celebrating this political coup, you could say, that the right-wing Ukrainians were able to carry out. So, bad news all around. No change in policy from the Harper years here at all.
And yet, when I listen to the CBC radio talk about Ukraine and the Crimea, they continue to insist that Russia has annexed Crimea and that the coup in Ukraine that began all of this bloodletting never really happened, but this was a popular revolution. Well, right now, Roger, you're following, I'm sure, what's going on. There's daily demonstrations within Kiev to try to get rid of the crooks. Nobody wants anything to do with these guys. Even the Europeans are walking away in droves. They can't do business with these guys. Any money they get seems to go in the front door and out the back.
That's right. I mean, it's a bad situation in Ukraine. Economically, the country is, you know, it's just plummeting downward. And this is the word, plummeting. We're not talking about, you know, declines in economic production and performance, you know, in the 1%, 2%, and 3%. We're talking the double digits and inflation and the drop in the value of the currency and so on. And so the standing, the political standing of Ukraine's politicians now among the Ukrainian public is at the lowest level ever, including, you know, the President Poroshenko, who was elected in May of 2014. So a really disastrous economic situation, a pretty disastrous political situation for the leaders of the country. The only thing that's saving them is that, you know, there's not really a strong and credible alternative to all this that's emerged yet in Ukraine. The ceasefire, which is now, remember now, just a little bit more than a year ago, the ceasefire agreement in Minsk, Belarus, Minsk 2 as it's called, you know, 12 very, very, you know, clearly spelled out steps in a ceasefire process in Ukraine. This has not taken place, and in fact, in the last couple of months, there's an escalation again of Ukrainian army and paramilitary shelling and so forth in the east of the country. And it doesn't matter how many polls of the Crimean people are taken, showing very strong satisfaction with the decision to secede from Ukraine and rejoin, as I call it, rejoin the Russian Federation. It doesn't matter how many polls showing this that are taken. You know, the propaganda story in the Western media is the same. You know, there's Russian annexation of Crimea, coming disaster in Crimea, all these stories that float and really have no bearing on the real situation in Crimea itself, which is, you know, it's a situation that's difficult but progressing. So, yeah, it's a bad story all around.
Yeah,
there's a very good interview with Professor Nikolai Petro, who's teaches at the University of Rhode Island. I recommend that on our website. It's a recent interview with him, kind of summarizing the situation in Ukraine. And he's by no means someone who could be painted as being some kind of, you know, someone sympathetic to the Russian government per se. I do recommend that interview for listeners that want to get more about the present situation in Ukraine.
Well, that's new, coldwar.org, a very informative site. Just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Roger Annis. Roger is a longtime socialist, trade union activist, prolific essayist in the cause of social justice and peace, both here in Canada and abroad. He's contributing editor at the website we just mentioned, newcoldwar.org. He's written there extensively on Ukraine and other things as well. And he's also found at his website, A Socialist in Canada, at rabble.ca and counterpunch.org, one of my favorites. And his latest article is Syria Ceasefire, a Triumph of Diplomacy, but Militarism Still Rules in Ottawa and Other Western capitals, is on this cessation agreement. Well, you mentioned Roger Minsk II, and that doesn't, that, I mean, as well as Minsk I, that they were never really adhered to. And again, it was Russia that moved in to provide the diplomacy necessary to stop a hot war, and they came to the aid. They saved, well, who knows what. And whoever aided them in the United States has been excoriated as well. Well, now we see that in Syria there's been an agreement. Is this going to go the same way as Minsk, do you think?
Well, we certainly hope not. I think that there's additional actors in the situation in Syria that is, you know, the allies that Russia has been working with on this issue, which may bode better for the Syria ceasefire than the one in Ukraine. And I'm glad you brought up the example of Ukraine, because now we have, you know, we have two, you know, really pretty fundamental developments in which the you know, diplomacy led by the Russian government has, you know, helped to, avert calamitous further descent into military conflict and war. In the case of Ukraine, I mean, Russia is kind of there in Eastern Europe, on the border of, you know, hostile governments all around it. We've got something different in Syria. We've got the government of Iran, which has, you know, a strong moral as well as political interest in a ceasefire. Of course, we have a national government in Syria itself. And increasingly, and this is a very interesting part of the story now in Syria, is that, you know, the Kurdish population in northern Syria, you know, are finding that, you know, perhaps there's a political accommodation possible with the Syrian government that was, you know, that was not there at the outset of the war situation 4 years ago. And that's certainly an encouraging development as well. So, you know, if what I wrote in the article is, and, you know, just by looking at what people were doing and saying factually, I mean, the ceasefire in Syria is a blow to the regime change aspirations of the United States and the coalition that it leads. And some members of that coalition, specifically Turkey and Saudi Arabia, are saying, well, we don't care what the United States agreed to with Russia. We still want to overthrow the Syrian government. Now they're having to, you know, they're having to obey the ceasefire for now. But no, it's an extremely fraught and dangerous situation in Syria. I would say even more so than in Ukraine. There are ongoing violations of the ceasefire in Ukraine being perpetrated by the Ukrainian government, but I think it's unlikely in any short term we could see a full-scale resumption of war there. A lot of reasons for that, including the very bad shape of Ukraine's own economy and armed forces. Syria, different story. We've got much larger, more powerful forces involved. Just very dangerous dynamics you play. I mean, Turkey is presently at war already with part of its population in the east of its own country. And we know what Saudi Arabia is doing in Yemen right now. And so, yeah, all bets are off. But boy, they, you know, this regime change alliance has taken some blows in Syria. They've been shown, I think, to the world as being warmongers. And to the extent that they talk about peace in Syria, they're shown to be hypocrites.
Well, and I heard today, this morning on NPR radio, the American public service, intimations that the Americans were happy to allow the Saudis to move into Syria as if they were the uptick of their military involvement there wouldn't be in violation of the cessation of hostilities agreement. What about the role that the Saudis are playing here?
Well, they're you know, I'm sure they're sitting down in conferences as we speak, figuring out if there's some way that we can get around this this ceasefire and keep up the pressure for regime change in Syria. I found a very interesting report. I'm trying to remember the source. Listeners can find it on the New Cold War website. Several weeks ago, there was a frank discussion between the United States and Syria, with, you know, Turkey being there in the background as well, of whether they could introduce ground troops into Syria precisely to avoid a ceasefire to the advantage of the Syrian government. So they were already talking about this a couple of weeks ago, and so I think that's where the attentions of the Saudi government and the Turkish government, you know, both of them very close allies to the United States, are focused right now. Can we defeat the ceasefire and get back to regime change warfare in Syria? That's the real danger of the situation today. And I hope, I'm cautiously optimistic that those ambitions will be frustrated. But boy, it's, you know, there's no guarantee of that at all. We're in very dangerous waters with this.
Well, we hear a lot of in the Canadian media, CBC especially, some really heartrending stories about the crisis of the refugee crisis. It's interestingly often framed as a crisis for Europe, as if it's not a crisis for the Syrians and others in the region that are fleeing. What about the dynamic, Roger, of this great influx, this great diaspora of refugees out of the region.
You know, it's interesting how this has played out in Canada because, you know, the Canadian government has, you know, welcomed 5,000 refugees. By the way, a very small number of refugees compared to what Jordan, Turkey, Lebanon, Greece, for goodness sake, countries that are far less able financially and otherwise to sustain, you know, hundreds of thousands of refugees. Well, Canada sort of talks about this as if they're the biggest savior in the world. I mean, this is a relatively small part of it. But anyway, what you never hear discussed in the with respect to the Canadian policy on Syrian refugees is why the heck are these people being forced to come here in the first place?
Right.
I'm sure if you did a poll with most of the refugees, Syrian refugees arriving in Canada, they would say, well, you know what, if we could have a peaceful homeland and some economic prospects in the future, thank you very much. We'd like to be at home in Syria right now, but we can't be because we've had a war brought down on our heads, by an imperialist regime change alliance. So that part of the story is never discussed. And so now with the ceasefire, I mean, you're not seeing in Western mainstream media any kind of welcoming of the ceasefire. There's a begrudging going on here.
Yeah.
And in fact, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal just a week ago, which one of our colleagues who writes for Russia Insider, Alexander Markouris, did a very important deconstruction of that article. First of all, drawing it to our attention, and then showing, look, you know, they're talking in Washington, they're bemoaning this ceasefire that's coming out, and there's a bit of a falling out among them now about, oh, who caused this? Why wasn't Obama more aggressive in Syria so we could have headed off the Russian intervention that led to this and so on? So
oh,
I mean, that's still where they're at.
Who allowed this horrible peace to break out after all, right?
Honestly, it's right there in the Wall Street Journal.
But, you know, what's also not mentioned either is the fact that before all of this, Syria was home to, I can't remember the number, but between 1 and 2 million Iraqi refugees.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, there's some very serious discussion to be had about, you know, what could the Syrian government have been doing, you know, 4, 5, even 10 years ago to, create, let's call it a greater democracy in the country or something, but, I think there are things that the government could have been doing that could have averted this descent into war, if not a civil war. But, you know, I'm looking today at their commitment to the ceasefire. Yesterday, the president of Syria, committed to amnesty for, you know, rebel forces that lay down their weapons. You know, I think that there's a lot of international pressure that accompanies this ceasefire agreement where I think we can expect to see some serious moves towards political accommodation in Syria. Now, I know that idea, that claim on my part will just sound, you know, just sound outrageous to people who've been, you know, buying the regime change agenda in Syria. But no, I think there's a lot of, political factors that accompany this ceasefire, which I think potentially point Syria in a positive direction. And that's what anyone internationally who's genuinely concerned about the situation there should be trying to draw attention to. And so the first thing, if we are to accomplish progress in Syria, is to put an end to the regime change intervention, which is still there and which still threatens the country.
You just heard Chris Cook of CFUV in Victoria interviewing Roger Annis for the radio program Guerrilla Radio. Listeners can access this and other interviews by visiting the site www.guerrilla-radio.com. Roger Annis's talk at the Geopolitical Economy Research Group conference was recorded and mastered by Sean Kane and Nicholas Coquet. It can be obtained free of charge from the website www.gergconference.ca, as well as the website newcoldwar.org. The Global Research News Hour will be back next week with more special programming. If you would like to leave a comment on this or any of our past shows, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. My name is Michael Welch.